Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How long could you feed your family, pay your rent or mortgage, and keep the lights on if you lost all or part of your current income? While the unemployment rate for college-educated Americans has dropped below 4%, for those with a college degree, that is, it remains close to 11% for the millions of Americans with less than a high school diploma. And many of those left unemployed or underemployed by the long economic downturn were those least prepared to weather an extended period without income. That's what operators at a Portland, Oregon 211 helpline discovered in the winter of 2011 and 2012 as they took record numbers of calls from people in dire straits.
I can't count the number of people I've spoken with who start their conversation with, "I never believed I would be in this situation." They say, "I have always worked." People are just stunned that they are suddenly in a position where not only did they get laid off, but their unemployment is running out or has run out because they cannot find a job. They think, "Well, I had money in my retirement account, and I had a savings account, and I used to take vacations, and I had new cars, and now I am struggling to put gas in my car."
That cut was from the new documentary American Winter, which followed eight of the families that called that Portland helpline through a long and challenging season of deprivation. Harry Gantz directed that film, which will be screened this coming Monday, November 18th at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas and is scheduled to air on HBO in March. Harry Gantz joins us now to talk about it as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. Harry, welcome to Think.
Hi, nice for having me. Thank you.
At the heart of this, this film really shows how easy it is for middle-class people to fall into poverty, and then once they get stuck there, how incredibly hard it is to climb back out.
Well, exactly. The film follows the life of eight families over several months as they fall into poverty, are seeking social services, and trying to find a way to get back on their feet. And during this last recession, everybody knows somebody who's fallen into poverty. Everybody knows somebody whose house has gotten foreclosed on, or they've lost their job, or they had a health condition. Many people are just one or two paychecks away from that situation, and it really is an epidemic in Texas and across the country.
How did you choose the families that you profiled here, and what did it take to convince them to open up their lives to you in such difficult times?
We're camped out at the 211 Center, and like you said, 211 is the number you call in most cities, I'm assuming in Dallas, if you need some type of social services. So we listened in on the calls, and we're just blown away by the level of suffering that these families were going through, and we're also blown away by their desire to help their situation. You know, most people want to work. They want the dignity of providing for their families. So we then asked them if they wanted to participate. We'd go out and interview them. They met us, and we met them. And most of them participated because they felt so alone. There's so much shame involved with being in this situation. And they felt like if they could help other families or create a sense of community rather than the isolation they were feeling and the shame they were feeling, then it would be worth the embarrassment involved with us following them and being in that situation.
I mentioned the education gap in my introduction, but it's worth noting that several of the families you profile here are headed by people who did go to college. And like John, a single father raising a son with Down syndrome, they're sort of shocked that they did everything right and still had their lives take this turn.
Exactly. Well, that's what makes this recession so different from others, where there is this whole population of formerly middle-class families who have fallen into poverty, and the social service agencies are doing their best to try to deal with that influx at the very time that all these cuts, whether they're federal or state, to the social service programs that are, you know, meant to help this population. And, you know, John is a great example because he had a great job. He was making over $50,000 a year and providing for his family. And being over 50 when he lost his job, he had worked since the time he was 14, so he thought it would be no problem getting another job. And he ended up going on unemployment, and then his unemployment ran out, and then he went on food stamps. And he was the kind of guy who said, Only deadbeats take food stamps. Well, of course, he felt very different when it involved, you know, providing for his son and trying to save his home.
Yeah, and another woman in the film is Deidre, who, again, did all the things she was told would let her earn a decent living, including going to college. At the start of the film, though, she's spending eight-hour days as, like, a metal scrapper and recycler to take home as little as $25.
Well, that's the point of the film, is that this 40-year movement in the media and politics to basically stereotype the people who need help as deadbeats, as welfare queens, as takers, has infected the populace. And so people in this situation, all they're trying to do is survive, but they're being told that there's something wrong with them. And there's a great example of a woman who did everything right, got laid off, and is doing whatever she can. But food stamps for a family of five, you know, and one of her sons is 6'2" and a state wrestling champion, 18 years old, you know what kind of food those guys are eating, it just doesn't make it. And the point is that many people are receiving social services in the film, and they're still working, as most people are who receive food stamps, for instance.
Yeah, there are a number of families that started out with two breadwinners and discover very quickly, you know, everybody sort of thinks, well, you know, God forbid I lose my job, we'll get by on what my spouse makes for a while. They find very quickly that it doesn't work.
Or they're getting rehired at jobs that are half the salary.
Yeah.
So it's a huge difference of being paid, you know, $22 an hour and $11 an hour.
You know, another thing that I think really comes through in this film is the sort of psychic toll this takes, not only on relationships at home, but on how these individuals feel about themselves. They were proud to be contributing working members of society. That's all they want to do again. And every time they apply for a job and don't get it, they just feel worse and worse about themselves.
That's right. And these are parents, so they're feeling worse and worse about themselves, but doing their best to prop up their kids' spirit. And that's a very difficult thing to do if your lights have been turned out or you don't have running water and you're doing everything you can to help your family stay in their home. The toll it takes on the parents, even though they tried to shield their kids from it, they aren't able to. And it's even worse of a toll on the children who, for no fault of their own, are going to bed hungry, are going to bed without lights or heat or water. And the toll that it's taking on us as an entire society is outrageous.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't matter if you think the parents deserve to be in that situation because they made some mistake, although most of them didn't. Do the kids deserve to be in that situation when we're in the richest country in the world?
As a parent myself, every time I saw the kids, I spent 90 minutes essentially crying through this film, which please take that as a compliment, but it was very moving. But even the youngest of the kids seem to get it. They understand the kind of trouble their families are in, and they worry not about going to the movies or having new sneakers. They're worrying, along with their parents, about their parents' inability to get the lights paid for.
Exactly. And, you know, growing up middle class myself, I can't ever remember that being an issue for me or even friends that I knew who were less fortunate than I was. But when you look at it now, there's so many kids who are experiencing this. There's so many kids who are on school lunch, and there's a lot of shame just with that. Because the kids feel their parents' shame, and they sort of absorb it in a way that affects everything about them, their ability to succeed in their own life. When you look at all the great businesses that have been started, whether it's Apple Computer or other great ones that have happened in the last 40 years, the people who started those businesses came out of the middle class. And if you grow up too wealthy, you have no motivation. If you grow up too poor, you're just in the survival mode. So, you know, the whole intention of this film is to help take that shame out, you know, take the veil of shame off of these families and look at them as, you know, empower people who are in this situation to feel like they do have some choices. They can't take this into their own hands, and that this is part of a national movement. You've seen more in the news and in the culture around income inequality and poverty in the last 6 months than we've seen, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years. And it's no accident that that's happening at the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty. And we're part of the new War on Poverty, along with several other films and the social service agencies and even people in politics and government who are doing their best to address these issues.
It's incredibly hard for these people to ask for help, even when it's evident they need it. Can you talk about one of your subjects, Paula? She goes for the first time to a food bank. She's incredibly grateful to be able to feed her kids, but she's a mess.
Well, right, because she had a vision of herself. In that case, they were really an upper-middle-class family. Mm-hmm. And her husband had a very good job, and they were living the, quote, American dream. He had just bought their house, but timing is everything. It happened right at the beginning of the recession, and he lost his job, and their child got sick, and they ended up losing their house. And to go from any status, whether it's upper-middle-class, middle-class, lower-middle-class, to poverty is very difficult. And many of the people who called into 211 who were in similar situations are calling in for the first time. But it's almost like they wait for the sheriff's knocking at the door because they can't even imagine themselves being in that position. So they're desperate, and 211 is such an important asset because many people don't even know how to navigate the social service system. Who do you call if you need energy assistance? Who do you call if you're a single father and you need a shelter? Well, without 211 or other organizations like it, these families would be lost because sometimes it's a full-time job just to get the benefits.
My guest is documentary filmmaker Harry Gantz. His film American Winter will be screening November 18th at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas and will air on HBO in March. We're speaking to Harry Gantz as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
I hear them in bed sometimes saying, "We skip dinner because we need to feed our kids." It makes you feel that it's your fault that they have to pay food for us, and that's wasting their money for us. Sometimes when I hear that, I cry sometimes.
Another cut from the documentary American Winter. We have its director, Harry Gantz, with us today. The film will be screening November 18th at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas and is scheduled to air on HBO next March. We're talking to Harry Gantz today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Harry, the kids in this not only understand the problem, but a lot of them feel responsible, even though that is the absolute last thing that their parents would want.
Well you're right. And my heart goes out, and as every viewer of the film's heart goes out to these kids, because they're between a rock and a hard place. They feel like their parents are struggling because of them, and if they weren't around, that their parents wouldn't be struggling. And they take it upon themselves in a way that just breaks your heart, and it makes them grow up so much faster than they should have to.
There's one little girl, she's about 10, and she's had some serious health issues. Her mom is employed and remains employed throughout the film. Before her daughter's health crisis, they were doing okay, but $50,000 in medical bills will change that quickly for a family.
That and medical leave. So she's a single parent, and she had to take off several months. And during that process, she lost her insurance. Although she got it right back, she still had thousands and thousands of medical bills. And the kid knows that. She knows that this is happening and blames herself. So it is heart-wrenching, and it's so relevant to all the issues that are happening in politics right now with the Affordable Care Act, to unemployment insurance, to food stamps. I mean, there are policy issues that can help solve this, and I know that the Democrats and the Republicans have very different ideas of how best to do that, but the one thing we can all agree upon across party lines is this is an epidemic, and if the middle class is lost in our country, it will be the end of our country as we know it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Timmy in Dallas. Hi, Timmy.
Hello. Yes, I'll try to make it short, but it's very difficult. You know, everyone who comes to this country, except for very few of the elite, when they began in this country back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago, were impoverished. However, today we seem to out of sight, out of mind. We have people impoverished, and yet there's problems with that. You create a mentality there where people are desperate. They get into trouble out of that desperate situation and end up in a penal system, which there is a lot of money thrown at a prisoner. It's, I think, costs something like $50,000 a year.
Well, interesting points to me, and I appreciate your call. That is not the case for anyone in this film. No one gets desperate enough to commit a crime as far as we know, Harry.
No, but you can see how somebody would if mm-hmm. it was between feeding their family or not feeding their family. And certainly I'm here in the Midwest. The methamphetamine epidemic, I think, is partly caused by the economic desperation. Mm-hmm. You lose hope. What's left? And, you know, I'm 55 years old, so I came of age in the late 70s. And I think the whole country had a much more sense of hope and possibility. And you felt like if you were even graduating high school, if you did the right thing, you were going to get a job and be able to support your family and have a decent life. For most people, I think that dream is gone. And it's our job to help rebuild it and look at this as a Sputnik moment when we need to, as a society, decide if we're all in this together or it's going to be, you know, us against them. And I'm hoping that the film helps inspire the all in this together mentality.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about that, because it's pretty clear that a lot of these individuals don't expect anything but scorn, even from people who might have been their friends. There's one young woman, a mother, who's, I guess, moving back in with her own parents, along with her husband or her own mother. And she says, I can't get on Facebook anymore because I can't tell people that, you know, that we're moving back in with my mom and that things are going so badly. She feels like people will judge her.
Well, after 40 years of the media and certain political factions doing everything they can to shame those people, to make people feel like it's their fault, to deflect the idea that policies or business may have something to do with this, beyond the control of the people who are actually in this position, we're trying to help reverse that trend. And we're part of, like I say, a national movement, whether it's in film or the news or politics. Four of the family members of the film were invited by Senator Merkley from Oregon to speak in front of the Banking Committee's Economic Policy Subcommittee on the death of the American dream. Hmm. And so for a rare day, the one group without a lobbyist in Washington, the working poor, had a voice. And I think that got the attention of the Republicans as well, because a month later, Paul Ryan this summer did a House hearing on the war on poverty. So the politicians are starting to pay attention. When close to 50% of the country is at or near the poverty level, that's a pretty powerful voting block. And we're hoping to, you know, empower those people that are in that position to look at their vote as something that can really make a difference in their pocketbook in the long run.
And that definition of working poor is one that I think people don't necessarily understand. I think it comes up in the film that for a parent supporting two children, the absolute minimum salary income that they can have to get by reasonably well is something like $21,000 a year. That's significantly above the minimum wage.
Well, good point. As the woman in the film who was in that position of feeling embarrassed around posting her situation on Facebook, when she testified in front of the United States Senate, there was a discussion between two senators about what a minimum wage should be. And it went from the current minimum wage, I guess, around $7.50 to $10 to $15. And she broke in and said, "Do you know what it's like to live on $15 an hour in Oregon? Do you know what I have to do in order to scrape by and do that?" As I said, the majority of the people receiving food stamps are working. And the one thing I got from sitting in at 211 and listening to those calls day after day is that most people want the dignity of having a job that they can provide for their families. They're not looking to bilk the system. Like you said, there's a lot of shame in even having to go to apply for it. They're looking for a quick solution to help them out of the survival mode so they can get back into society and find a job and get rid of some of their debt and, you know, reestablish their foot in the middle class.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Tom in Hearst. Hello, Tom.
Hi. There's a very apropos article today in the Wall Street Journal in the op-ed section that goes into some real statistical data on the diminishing of the middle class, and it's just it's dramatic. A couple that I remember were, in 1971, 61% of all American adults were living in what was defined as a middle-class home. Today it's 51. And in 1971, 65% of households in America were living in a middle-class neighborhood, and today it's 42. Hmm. Rather dramatic decrease.
And what's even more dramatic is the fact that that was an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal. One of the most conservative op-ed papers in the country is looking at this income inequality as a major social issue of our time. And, that's refreshing. At least they're paying attention. Hopefully the business leaders who are watching it are paying attention, because there's a lot people can do beyond simply raising the minimum wage. This last 3 or 4 years has seen major corporations mostly spending their extra cash on buying back stock rather than expanding or hiring people. You know, the most patriotic move you can do in big business is hire and expand and use this cash rather than just to enrich yourselves or enrich your shareholders to offer opportunity.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Another family that you profile in the film, Harry, is a woman named Jeanette and her son, Gunnar. And she was recently widowed. And so at the beginning of the film, they're like living in somebody's unheated garage. Ultimately, they end up moving to a homeless shelter. And one thing that I think would strike a lot of viewers of the film is that the population of this homeless shelter doesn't look like what we sort of imagine it will look like. It's young families.
Well, that's the message of the entire film, that people's idea of people who need help are maybe mentally ill people or drug addicts who are begging in city centers. But that has changed. As I said, during this recent recession, the formerly middle class have just stretched social services beyond what they can handle. And the face of poverty is very different. That's why I'm encouraging everybody to come out in Dallas on Monday night to see the film at the Angelica Film Center. Our hosts, we're very appreciative they're bringing it, the Dallas Democratic Party. You can learn more about the film at the Dallas Democratic Party's website or their Facebook page.
There's a moment that's striking, too, when the little boy, Gunnar, has like a stomach virus, which is something that every parent deals with their kids. And his mother is just heartbroken that he has to cope with this thing and he's not in his own home. And it, you know, for a moment, we're happy that at least they're somewhere safe and warm. And then you realize how awful that must be to be in a situation like that and not be able to provide comfort to your own child.
Exactly right. There is not a parent who will watch this film and can't be affected by it. It doesn't matter what your politics are. All of us, it's part of human nature to feel like children are our future and it's our job to protect them and provide for them. And if an individual can't do it because of whatever circumstances, I believe it is our responsibility as a society, especially a country like America that has the resources to feed everybody, that has the resources to put everybody in a home. That doesn't mean it's a handout. That means it's an investment in this whole population of poor or the working poor who are only looking for a little help to get back up. Most of these social service agencies, people visit them once.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Alan in Plano. Hi, Alan.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I really wanted to thank you for doing this show. I really appreciate this. I wish I would have known about 211 whenever I was when I was unemployed. I was calling, I through a strange turn of events, I actually ended up getting out of 2-year unemployment kept having small businesses that I was working for shutting down because of the recession. And it finally gave me the push that I needed to get out and start my own sole proprietorship. And it's very strange, but I don't think I would have been able to do that had I not left the comfort of a regular paycheck.
Hmm.
So it's very
strange.
Well,
that's a very good
difference.
Point, because sometimes necessity is the motivation we need. But could you imagine that you could probably give back now to other people in your position, teaching them how to start their own businesses? Because it's not just survival that we're interested in. So many social service agencies are so overwhelmed that that's all they can do is do their best to try to feed and clothe people. But part of the problem is that entrepreneurial spirit that we have to put in folks, because you know, $10 an hour isn't going to get you out of poverty. It's just going to, again, help you survive. And so that's a great example of a way to take this issue, this problem, and make it the solution by starting a business.
And there's this idea as well, you know, $10 an hour is not going to get you out of poverty. Being rehired at almost any salary after a lengthy period of unemployment is not an overnight solution to one's problems. It's sometimes really just the beginning of trying to dig their way out of all the debt they've gotten into.
Well, sure, there's no shame in a $10 an hour job. And mm-hmm. if it's an organization where if you work hard and do the right thing, there's an opportunity for advancement, that's great. But it seems that there is an entrenchment here where most of the jobs that have been created in the last 4 or 5 years have been service jobs that really don't have the type of future that will help people get out of poverty. And part of that is education. Part of that is business. You know, we aren't sociologists. We aren't economists. We're filmmakers, and we can put a face on it. And the intention is to motivate those people who are in those positions and to motivate the entire population to get behind this issue. Robert Shiller, the economist who just won the Nobel Peace Prize, said that income inequality is the major social issue of our time, both nationally and worldwide. And if we don't solve it, it's going to be a lot of chaos in the future.
Back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Jose on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jose.
Hi, Chris. I wanted to make a quick comment. I'm currently unemployed, back in school. I worked in the IT field for 20 years. And even back then, I remember getting paid and looking at my check stub. And I can say I never felt as patriotic as when I saw that number that was being detracted from my pay that would go to somebody who needs it. Hmm. It's nice to celebrate the 4th of July or Veterans Day, but I think that we need to kind of appreciate when we actually do our part and pay our taxes, number one. Secondly, I think that we as a society, if America is going to continue to be a leader, we have to change how we promote our values. We talk a lot about family values, but we don't actually invest in our family, whether it's education or otherwise. And in this case, we have to look out for the families that are struggling. I just kind of wanted to put that out there. Maybe it's time that we change our portfolios to how much money we make to what charities we contribute to or what type of work we do to help the needy. Thanks.
Thanks so much for your call. Do you want to respond to any of that, Harry?
That's a great point. It's a great point that rather than trying to find a tax haven in the Bahamas or think about, you know, what next electronic gadget I can buy, he looks at his paycheck and says, I'm proud that I was able to provide for those who don't have a job or who are worse off than me. And the other deduction that comes off that's a good point is Social Security. You know, people keep talking about that as an entitlement program. But Social Security is an insurance program. It's like an annuity that we've all paid into. And so that's our money. That's not an entitlement. Nobody giving us that. We worked for it. And to think that, you know, the discussions and the debates start with already cutting Social Security or changing the index or cutting food stamps. It's unbelievable that at a time of recession, when the need is the greatest, that the political moves are all around cutting.
My guest is director Harry Gantz. His documentary American Winter will be screening November 18th at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas and will air on HBO in March. We're speaking to him as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372.
Mm-hmm. funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
We have these trade policies with other countries, which have been enormously beneficial to the owners of companies because it turns out to be incredibly useful to be able to relocate where we manufacture or create our products to places where workers have no power, right? Where you don't have to pay them anything and you don't have to worry about pollution regulations or anything like that. What Congress hears about is how fantastic that is for business. And it is fantastic for the shareholders in the near term of the businesses. But what it doesn't account for is the long-term health of the American economy. The only people who suffer are the workers, and the only people who benefit are the owners. The sort of typical American family has been completely railroaded.
That is the voice of venture capitalist Nick Hanauer, as featured in the new documentary American Winter, which will be screening November 18th at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas. We have the documentary's director, Harry Gantz, with us today to talk about this as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Harry, talk about the inclusion of people like Nick Hanauer in the film and why you felt like that was important to also have people who have money and still feel that it's important to pay attention to those who are really struggling right now.
Well, we shot the film in the Pacific Northwest in Portland, Oregon, and we wanted the sort of the experts or the people who had to speak to this from the academic or the business perspective to be from that region. And Nick Hanauer is a very well-known industrialist and was one of the original investors in Amazon and sold another company to Microsoft. So he's a billionaire, and he has a perspective that we wanted to bring to the film, a one percenter who realizes that we're all better off when we're all better off. And I think the point he makes that businesses need a middle class to buy their products, and that helping somebody, whether it's through food stamps or any other type of social program, is a benefit to the entire society, including business. So it doesn't matter whether your intentions are humanitarian or they are economic. It will benefit us all if we can create policies that lift more people out of poverty into the middle class than if we continue on this so-called trickle-down economic that was instigated by Reagan and has proved not to work.
Let's go next.
As he points out, if it was working, how come there's all these poor folks?
Let's go next on the phone to Arlington, where we have Ed on the line. Hello, Ed.
Hi, Chris. I can say from having lived most of the last 30 years in Portland, although I haven't seen the movie yet, I can say with some certainty that the social safety net in Oregon, as bad as your film may show it, the social safety net in Texas is worse. Unemployment benefits are far less generous. I've worked, when I was in Portland, I helped start a tenants' rights organization, so I've worked with the class of people that I understand your film to show. The amount of income that it takes to qualify for Medicaid in Texas is ridiculously low. A few other points. I think the guy that called earlier suggesting that unemployment benefits as a way to sole proprietorship success, that's a bit of an unintentional red herring. The number of businesses, small businesses that fail is astronomical. And so I don't think that we need to be looking at that. The biggest problem with unemployment benefits, it's a real catch-22, and that is that people on unemployment benefits get kicked off if they're caught going to college full-time. You cannot both collect unemployment benefits and be a full-time student. That's ridiculous. We need to be encouraging people to upgrade their skills so that they can qualify for new jobs after they've lost their old ones.
Well, what do you think about all that, Harry?
I think that's a great point. And the fact that we made this in Portland, which does have decent social services, which has an Oregon health program for any child who needs it, and still they the social service agencies, whether they're government, nonprofit, secular, or nonprofit, religious, are taxed beyond, not taxed, but are have more clients than they can possibly help. So if it's that bad in Oregon, I can only imagine what it's like in Texas.
Can you talk a little bit about the filmmaking process? I mean, as I mentioned, for me as a viewer, it was wrenching to watch. I have to imagine it was a very intense several months for you to follow these families around.
It was, because both my brother and I, who were the filmmakers, are parents, and so were several of the crew members. And to be in that situation where a child is hungry, or to be in that situation where they have no light or running water, and to know that, you know, in a couple hours, you're going to go back to your hotel room and be able to eat whatever you want, or that you even have a bag full of snacks out in the car for your crew that you could easily give to them, but can't, because that would change their situation. All the families knew that they were being paid for their participation, but not until after the filming was over, so it wouldn't change or affect their situation. But you're right, it was heart-wrenching, and it continues to be, because some of these families are still in the dire straits, and we, of course, have stayed in touch with them, and many of them have come to some of the screenings and been a part of this movement to bring the film to people across the country.
Let's go next on the phone to John in Fort Worth. Hello, John.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Mr. Gant. And I just want to say I praise you for making this film, and it makes me think of a great literary masterpiece in film, The Grapes of Wrath, that was written by John Steinbeck. He took a true event that happened in the Dust Bowl, and he replayed it with fictional characters. And maybe there's a comment that we're living this again.
Well, that's a very good point, and thank you for that compliment. But you see what happened in the 30s when part of the WPA project was actually to document what was going on for people in poverty so it would justify the government spending money at the levels they were. So Dorothea Lange's photographs that you see in every history book of the Dust Bowl, and as he mentioned, John Steinbeck's, helped the country to embrace this spending spree, helped the country to embrace the war on poverty in the 60s. And it's almost like this could be happening in a third world country now, and nobody knows about it. Because prior to our film coming out, most people, upper middle class or above, had no idea even what 211 is, let alone that, you know, their neighbors one neighborhood over could easily be in dire straits that are just as bad as poverty in third world countries.
And
so he's right. It is very important for us to tell the stories to help inspire the nation to get behind whatever movement that you feel is going to help solve this issue. We obviously are from the left of center, my brother and I, and feel like the solutions are from that side of the aisle. But we're open to any side. I mean, I was preparing in my discussion here to talk to folks in Texas because our impression is that, you know, the Tea Party's controlling everything down there. And obviously that's not the case. When you hear the call and, you know, a lot of them feeling very empathetic towards people in that position or in that position themselves and realize that a policy of cut is not going to get us out of this.
Well, as I'm sure you understand, about any part of the country, it's impossible to paint an entire state with a single brush one way or another.
That's right, but we haven't heard one call from the right side of the aisle yet.
One other thing that the film really highlights that I think people may not be aware of is that in cases where there are assistance programs available, sometimes they're maybe by necessity sort of bureaucratic, so that a family who might have applied to have help paying their utilities, once those utilities get cut off, there is nothing in place that allows them to get the power back on or get help paying until they have paid off that bill. There's a lot of sort of runaround that people are required to do even to try and get some services.
Well, you're right. It's different in every city because every city has different utilities that service it. And there are both state laws and regulations that the utilities themselves are trying to uphold. But in general, it often is a full-time job to get services. For instance, we would follow someone who's trying to get energy assistance, and they've never asked for it before, but they want to avoid getting their lights turned off. So they call the 211, and 211 refers them to another agency. And that agency says, you can't come in because we don't want a line around the corner. So you have to call in at the first of the month, and you got to call in at 9 o'clock. And the first 200 callers will get help, and after that, you're screwed. So, you know, the bureaucracy involved is a necessity because these social service agencies only have so much money to work with. But I can imagine being in that situation is quite frustrating because is it the guy who's got the best automatic dial on his cell phone that, you know, gets the help?
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Liz on the line in Dallas. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Harry. Great show. Two quick points. First, I think it was Henry Ford who said, who of course developed the automobile, who said, you know, I can make Model Ts all day long, but if I don't pay my people a livable wage, then who is going to buy them? That's my first point. We've sent far too many jobs overseas, and we don't have the economic base in place. The second point I'd like to make is that it is a bureaucracy problem. When in 2008 we had the financial crisis, I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he just did a piece in the Wall Street Journal. He had left the Fed and returned because he was asked to head up a program whereby we would put money into these banks that were too big to fail. And he was apologizing to the American public because all it really turned into was the banks basically hoarding the money, making money with the money, be darned the taxpayer who's funding it. And, you know, it's crazy. These guys are just bilking the system at the top. There's no punishment for them. You know, Chase Bank just got fined, what was it, $5 billion for manipulating the LIBOR, the base rate upon which all interest rates are built. And has anybody gone to jail? And I'll just take your comments off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, being a filmmaker, I don't think it's my job to blame the banks or blame the system. It's more my job to try to inspire the populace, including people in business, that this is a major problem in our time and that it's only going to be solved if everybody gets behind it. So it can't just be activists who believe that, you know, we should spend more money and invest in the working families. It's got to be big business, and it's got to be big government that gets involved in this. And I know big government is a bad word, but the truth is Social Security is big government, and it's kept millions of elderly people out of poverty. So if we don't inspire all of us working on this together and feel like we're in it together, then it's not going to be solved. So rather than prosecuting the banks, I'm looking at them and investing in businesses that are going to hire people. And I'm rather than blaming big business, I'm hoping to inspire them to take that money and rather than put it back into their shareholders' hands, but use it to expand. And in the long run, that will not only create customers, but it will make their business base bigger.
You mentioned that you are still, just on a personal basis, following a number of the people that you profile in the film, and a number of them are still struggling 2 years later.
That's right. John, for instance, the gentleman you mentioned earlier who has the son with Down syndrome, he's still unemployed, but he's gone back to school. He's making ends meet by umpiring on the weekends and doing odd jobs. And he is still fighting Wells Fargo over his eviction. I don't know if the attention that he's gotten from the film has slowed that down. If that's fine, that's okay. But he's in a very similar situation. Paul and Ben have improved their situation, but others, Tara and TJ, are still struggling. She's still working at a minimum wage job, and he's getting odd jobs but not a full-time job. And a lot of the people are in a similar situation.
Filmmaker Harry Gantz directed the new documentary American Winter. There will be a screening of the film this coming Monday, November 18th, at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas. And you'll be there for that screening, Harry?
That's right.
Okay.
I'm coming to Dallas.
And
I look forward to it.
There's a Q&A following the film, I gather.
That's right. And there's a great panel that the Democratic Party has put together. And every screening we do, rather than doing a traditional screening where you put your film in a theater for a week or two and it's a sad documentary and nobody comes, we're doing it in cooperation with local organizations who are fighting this fight every day. and are very happy that the Democratic Party has invited us, and they put together a great panel discussion afterwards.
Great. That, again, takes place November 18th at the Angelica. The film will also air on HBO in March. Harry joined us today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative, which you can learn more about at kera.org/onecrisisaway. Listen this afternoon during All Things Considered when KERA's Courtney Collins profiles Dallas County 211, considered the starting gate for assistance, and you can learn then about how to sift through your own options. Harry, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help today from Christina Martinez on the phones. Christine McConnell prepares the podcast, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.